I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
Hi there, I'm Lale Arakoglu. This is the third installment of our Slow Travel Stories. I'm with writer Laura Coffey, and on today's Women Who Travel, we're sailing to islands that resemble the fictional locations in the adventures of The Odyssey.
The book is about following parts of Odysseus's journey and finding these little mystical Mediterranean islands that various different scholars through time have said were the inspiration for the fantastical lands of the Odyssey. And there's lots of different theories about which islands around the Mediterranean could have corresponded to which lands in the Odyssey. And they're all based basically on kind of whimsy or things like a particular cave or the arrangement of the stars on a specific island.
I grew up learning about the Greek myths. I feel like lots of children do. I had a children's book about them that really captivated my imagination. I think, you know, the Odyssey obviously is one of the most famous. Actually, when I try to think of the story, I can't really remember it. What is the story beyond it being an epic trip?
It's basically this guy, Odysseus, who I think in modern terms we'd call a narcissistic, polyamorous guy who's a bit of a dick. And he has just finished fighting in the Trojan War. And he was the guy who came up with the idea of the Trojan horse that helped them win the war. So he's really clever, he's quite sneaky, he's very wily, but he's quite arrogant, he's pissed off the gods, and they are preventing him from getting home to his island of Ithaca. That's his home island. And he's basically doing island hopping, except he doesn't get to choose the route. And it's been going on for 10 years when we meet him in the story.
It was a challenge to trace Odysseus's journey. Where, for instance, is the island of the Lotus Eaters, or Calypso's island, and the island of Helios?
There's all of these crazy, bonkers theories surrounding the geography of the Odyssey. So scholars across time have been thinking about which islands across the Med could have been the land of the sun god, which island could have been Calypso's island, where Odysseus was imprisoned for 7 years, basically as her sex slave on this island. Different scholars had their different theories. For example, Strabo, who's one of the ancient Greek scholars that came after Homer, he thought Sicily was the island of the sun god. And that makes sense when we look at kind of modern day Sicily. It's got like 2,000 hours of sunshine a year or something. So of course that could be the island of the sun god.
You know, it's funny. In my head, I always think that the Odyssey is really centered around Greece, but it's not, because you're talking about Sicily and places like that.
Yeah, I think the ancient Greek world, it doesn't map to modern day Greece. And a lot of people think about the Odyssey and Greek myths as happening only in modern day Greek islands. But of course, the world at that time was different, was far larger than that. Various different theories have parts of the Odyssey happening on the North African coast, for example. So it's finding these little known islands and discovering these places. And then you've got people like Samuel Butler, who was a 19th century satirical Victorian. And he was convinced that Homer had been misgendered, actually. He thought that Homer was a woman and not a man. And his thesis was that Marettimo, which is one of these tiny islands off the Sicilian coast, was in fact Ithaca, rather than the island that's called Ithaca in modern day Greece. So these were the kind of theories I was following. And the idea of mapping myths is also really interesting, of trying to find these imaginative, fantastical places in the real world. And what was interesting to me was the gaps between the maps, I suppose, which was kind of thinking, well, you've got all of these different competing theories, then there's no right answer to it.
Laura's book is Enchanted Islands, Travels Through Myth and Magic, Love and Loss. It combines memoir, travel, and nature writing. And as with the best travel origin stories, this one began randomly, one afternoon, under the grey English skies.
I picked up the Odyssey for that most ancient of reasons, to impress a boy. Spoiler alert, he wasn't that impressed. We did end up breaking up.
I've got to ask, who's the boy?
This might be a do-over one, love. The boy in question was a guy I was dating, and he was very clever, let's just not get into that. Is that all right?
No, that's absolutely fine. I was just, going to crack a joke about men always thinking that they're better read than other people, but we'll leave it there.
I'm really grateful for Woodstock Bookshop, which is an independent bookshop, because I saw it glittering on the table there and I picked it up and then I put it back down because I thought, oh, it looks quite heavy. It looks difficult. And it was only when the bookseller said, this is a really brilliant translation. You really have to read it. And that's why I picked it up and put it in my bag, little knowing that this translation of this very old dusty myth would change my life. I sort of fell in love with the poem and more specifically Emily Wilson's translation. Emily Wilson's a professor at Penn University and she published a translation a couple of years ago. And what's really interesting is she stripped out all this overwrought insertions of 19th century poets and she stripped it right back to the kind of original musicality, muscularity in the poem. So it's super, super easy to read. It's very modern and fresh. And I kind of became really immersed in what I had thought would be a very intimidating text. But in Wilson's translation, it's really accessible.
Do you think there was something special about reading a translation from a woman? Because, there's so many of the stories that you're citing within the Odyssey are these men, these powerful men. Do you think that having a woman translating it gave the story something that perhaps you might not have connected to on another translation?
I don't know that it's specifically that Emily Wilson is a woman. I think it's more that she spent a lot of time stripping the poem back and she wanted to make the language simple. But I love that it is the first English translation by a woman. And she's now recently translated the Iliad as well.
It sounds like a lot when, in terms of mapping these myths, often it required looking at the stars or the landscape. Did it get you closer to just those very natural elements?
Yeah, I felt very close to nature, partly because these islands were so small. So one of my favourite islands is Favignana, which in the story is the Island of Wonders. And that is, I think it's 30 square kilometres. It's really little. And so that means you can hear and see the sea from practically anywhere on that island. And you're really conscious that you're on an island. And you're also exposed on islands to the winds, which is something I'd never really thought about living in London. I never could tell you which direction the wind was blowing from. I didn't think that was, why would that matter? But on an island, it does really matter. And it matters when you're swimming because there's a connection between where the wind's blowing from and your likelihood of getting jellyfish stings, which I found out through quite a lot of painful experimentation before I learned that rule. And there's also a really interesting thing about winds and how they affect you on islands. And in Korchla, there's a very ancient medieval law, supposedly, that when the Ugo wind blows, you cannot be prosecuted for a crime because the wind is known to send you out of your mind. So that would be a day that you could literally get away with murder.
God, that was fascinating. When I was in Mykonos a few months ago and I discovered that it's actually a famously windy island. Well, I guess maybe you can kind of do whatever you want there at times. Because the wind, it was great. It was the most memorable thing about it was just how windy it was. I'd never really thought about it that way.
Yeah, and I don't think you do until you get there. And I mean, there was a part when I was traveling where I got stuck on Korçula because of the winds. They wouldn't run the ferries. The seas were too rough. And then you see the kind of the flip side of islands. You see the isolation and feeling trapped and not being able to get off an island because of the natural elements. Myths are, in a lot of ways, the earliest geography lessons in the world. So when we didn't know how to explain phenomena, we would say that a volcano erupted because it was an angry god, or that people were lost at sea because Poseidon hadn't been given the right prayers before the ship set sail.
I love that. Coming up, the Odyssey is a 3,000-year-old myth, but Laura found that her own experiences sometimes seem to mirror the ancient collection of travellers' tales.
Hi, I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor of The New Yorker. Each week on the Writer's Voice podcast, New Yorker fiction writers read their newly published stories from the magazine. You can hear from authors like Colson Whitehead.
Turner nudged Elwood, who had a look of horror on his face. They saw it. Griff wasn't going down. He was going to go for it, no matter what happened after.
Or Joy Williams.
Her father was silent. Slowly, he passed his hand over his hair. This usually meant that he was traveling to a place immune to her presence, a place that indeed contradicted her presence. She might as well go to lunch.
Listen to new stories or dive into our archive of great fiction. You can find the work of your favorite fiction writers and discover new ones. Listen and follow The Writer's Voice wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you ever owned something that inspired you to level up? For me, it's my hiking boots, which have gotten me over some pretty tough terrain. And I'm not talking about my morning commute on the New York City subway. They've pushed me to go to far-off places like trekking in the remote mountains in Patagonia, wildlife spotting amid the thick rainforest of the Amazon, and climbing through canyons in the Utah desert. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. There's an available panorama glass roof, 33-inch all-terrain tyres, and multi-terrain select driving modes. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior means that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
I'm Tanya Mosley.
In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
The Odyssey turned into this 3,000-year-old ancient guidebook in a funny sort of way.
How did you start plotting your trip?
I started plotting my trip by consulting my Sicilian friend Laura, and she suggested this string of islands, seven volcanic islands just off the coast of Sicily called the Aeolian Islands. And they are named after the guardian of the winds, Aeolus. The way the Italians say Aeolian is they call it the Aeolian Islands, and they sort of say it with this sigh, and it sounds like the wind moving through the trees. So in the story, Odysseus washes up on this, they call it the floating island in the story, the floating island of the wind god. And it's a wonderful experience of island hopping. It's so much more straightforward than Greece. There's one ferry that goes between them. There's seven different islands, so you can pick. Lipoli is a fabulous place for couples. It's soft and romantic and beautiful. Stromboli was my favourite. And you can climb up one of the world's most active volcanoes, and you can see it erupting at night under this amazing dome of constellations, and you see the torches of the other hikers, and it looks almost like a sort of pilgrimage. It looks like candles lit along the mountainside, and you really feel the power of the volcano there. And you can imagine Estes and how, yeah, of course they thought it was a god, because it's this kind of incredible, powerful energy in this sort of incredibly wild island. There's something sort of like a pilgrimage about it. It feels significant. It feels like a pilgrimage.
Even at a safe distance, to see a volcano, an active volcano, is quite a terrifying thing to behold. I mean, it's quite an existential experience.
Yeah, I think at the time I had been so preoccupied with the smallness of my concerns, and, you know, it's just ending a relationship and you're feeling sad and alone, and then suddenly you're confronted by this kind of majestic nature. It feels like a way to kind of get re-enchanted with the beauty of the world, because it was about seeking out enchantment and working out where are places, what can we do to like kind of lift ourselves into that state of awe. And there's a whole science of awe. There's loads of enchantments in the Odyssey. The crew get turned into pigs by this witch. The wine at dinner gets spiked by Helen of Troy. She spikes it with a special powder to take away the bitter feeling of grief. Zeus sends thunderbolts to kill the crew and break the ship. There's tons of enchantments there. And I guess our modern day enchantments are all about the science of awe. So climbing mountains, having experiences different than the day to day, and reconnecting with the power of the natural world and the beauty that's all around us.
I think you have to be quite intentional about finding those moments of awe. In the modern world, they don't really just come to you. You have to seek them out. And it sounds like you were seeking them out.
Yeah, I had to actively seek them out. You're right. I went to spend some time in mainland Sicily, and I visited Marettimo, which is supposed to be Ithaca in the story. So that's supposed to be the island that Odysseus is desperately trying to get home to. He's desperately trying to get back to his beautiful, clever wife, Penelope. And she's in Ithaca. She's batting off the attentions of these younger suitors who think she's a widow and are kind of bit gold digging. So she's batting off her hot boyfriends. Her husband's running around trying to get back to her, simultaneously having affairs with various goddesses on various islands. But of course, Penelope, because she's a woman, has to stay faithful. So there's a bit of a double standard there in the story.
I know. I'm like, God, I want Penelope to just have a bit of fun.
Exactly. Where else did I go? Oh, Favignana, which is the island of wonders in the story. Odysseus and his exhausted crew have been trying to get back for ages, and they land on this island and they spend the day hunting goats, and then they barbecue the goats on the beach and they just chill out for a bit before they get back onto the next adventure. And the next adventure is to seek out the Cyclops, which is the one-eyed giant. And he is the son of Poseidon and a sea nymph. And he supposedly lives in one of the Balearic Islands. So I went to Menorca to see if I could find the Cyclops there. It's an example in the story of the normal code of guest friendship being violated. Odysseus goes into his cave and demands a present, because that's the protocol at the time, that when strangers turn up, you have to accommodate them. It's a sort of Airbnb without the ratings. And then he demands a present, which is, again, something the ancient Greeks used to give guests. They were supposed to give them the best beds, nice massages, nice warm baths. And the Cyclops, quite reasonably, refuses to give these people who have intruded into his cave. They've come there when he was out grazing his sheep. So he refuses to give them a present, and he traps them, and he starts snacking on the crew and eating them up. And Odysseus has to think about how he can use all his wits and all his cunning to get out of the situation. And he sharpens a stick and he plunges it into the Cyclops' one eye and then manages to escape. The Cyclops, bloodied and furious, then calls to his daddy, who is Poseidon, and asks him to make sure that Odysseus never gets home. So it's a great moment in the story because it's Odysseus in his arrogance who has kind of inflicted this whole situation. And now he's given a vengeful god a personal vendetta. And that's part of the reason that he can't get home.
As you traveled between these islands, how did your life start intersecting with these stories? You know, as you were tracking and looking for the fantastical in the real life, what was happening to you? Who were you meeting?
I was swimming in the kind of October and November and December seas, getting colder and colder and sharper and sharper buzzes of endorphins from that cold water. I found myself swimming with a 70-year-old naked guy called Andrew, Naked Andrew in the book, who is a very eccentric expat on Menorca. And he used to come to a particular cove, my favourite cove, and we got chatting there. And we would swim almost every day together. He thought I was a massive wimp. He'd call me an inadequate alpha female because I would take ages to get into the water. And but I would be like, listen, Andrew, I'm in the water for longer than you. So it kind of nets out in the end.
Yeah.
And in Cortula, there's this wonderful woman called Leia, who is a phytoaromatherapist, which means that she mixes oils and uses plant elixirs. And to my mind, she was very much a kind of modern day Circe, a modern day enchantress. And she went swimming with me there. So I tend to find the most interesting people when I'm cold water swimming as well. I ate in Frano's restaurant, and Frano sort of looked like a pirate captain, all dressed in black with this incredible bandana around his silver hair. And he used to cook me fresh fish over an open fire.
I want to go back to, you mentioned going cold water swimming, and that's something that a lot of people seem to be doing these days. We had a writer, Freya Bromley, come on the podcast a few months ago to talk about her wild swimming across the UK.
So I had started cold water swimming thanks to my friend Pella in London, who had dragged me to Hampstead Ponds and made me swim in December, and it was a kind of baptism of fire. So I'd done a little bit of cold water swimming in London. But it is one of those annoying, cliched self-care practices, I think, that everyone's picked up. But they've picked it up for a reason, because it really works. I was really worried about my father back home. He was very unwell. He was trying all these different cancer treatments. It was a terminal cancer, so he wasn't going to get better. But he was trying all of these different protocols, and I was worried about him. And I found that the cold water really stilled my mind and brought focus and clarity and took me back into my body. In a similar way to yoga, I'm a yoga teacher. I've been practicing yoga for, I think, 15 years now. And it's just another tool, another way, I think, of going back into your own physiology, away from your whirring, heavy, hot mind and reoccupying the body. And, you know, just even that struggle to breathe and trying to kind of calm your physiological reactions in the water.
You were traveling in some of the places in the world that have some of the best food and are famous for their incredible diets. What did you eat? And what role did food play in this, in your odyssey?
Food plays an enormous role in my life, generally, not just travel. But yes, I was in the world of culinary delights. I was in Italy and Sicily, and I was in a place called Castel Bueno, which is known for its mushroom pasta. And they forage for them with dogs, not pigs, like they do in France. And I got into a massive argument with a restaurateur who refused to believe that I don't like to eat mushrooms. And he sort of forced me to eat his mushroom pasta which was completely delicious and a total revelation. And he ended up sitting next to me at the table and bringing out all of these amazing rare truffles from the kitchen and explaining how to find them in the woods and their unit costs and the different tastes that they have. In Menorca, I stayed in a little town called San Luis, and I ended up cooking for myself a lot there. You go to a shop where you can buy eggs and they roll them in newspaper for you instead of putting them in egg boxes. So it was all very locally grown and delicious in Menorca. In Favignana, there's a restaurant called La Bettola where they sort of adopted me, and you can get the most delicious spaghetti there. And Lorenzo, who is the son of the owner, goes out every morning at 4 a.m. to catch calamari.
Coming up, Laura took 6 months, while Odysseus in the poem was wandering for 10 years, and he's encountering temperamental gods and goddesses.
From Foreign Policy, I'm Rina Ninen, the host of The Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women. Over the past few years, we've looked at how women around the world are changing societal norms to increase their economic power. This season, we're focusing completely on girls, how they're pushing for a brighter, more powerful future, and what the rest of us can do to set them up for success. Join us for stories about girl power, young women who are fighting for change, to give themselves a chance to live a life of their own choosing. That's season 6 of The Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women, wherever you get your podcasts.
In my book, Enchanted Islands, it's all about making this intimidating text very accessible and very non-academic.
As you kind of describe these scenes in this myth, they're all scenes that I've kind of like have been like fragmented for me, and I've never realized they're all in the same poem.
Well, it's a very long bloody poem. So there's loads of different scenes and things that happen in it.
I mean, I guess it was a famously long journey, so it had to be a long poem.
One could even call it an epic poem, perhaps.
You know, on a journey of that length, one hopes that Odysseus learnt a few things. What do you think you learnt on your trip?
Yeah, so Odysseus came back in the end. Spoiler alert, he does make it home. He does make it home to Penelope. And he has been, in Emily Wilson's translation, he's been humbled by these heartbreaking losses because, of course, he comes home and all his men have died along the way. So there's some issues with Odysseus's leadership style, I think. What I learned really was, I guess, to sort of let go a little bit and sort of being in the moment and having these like conversations with Italian restaurateurs about mushrooms. It's about hiking up the volcano that's so beautiful that the next day you want to do it all over again. And I suppose also being a little bit more open to being blown around by the fates and blown around by the winds. So that's what I learned.
How long were you gone in total?
2 weeks turned into 6 months. And then my dad became very suddenly very, very unwell. So I returned to the UK when he was dying. And it was only really when I returned to the islands after that that I felt more normal again. And so for me, there was so much, and the book talks about it quite a lot, there's so much in travel and the beauty of nature to console us and to help us move through these really difficult parts of life. There's something in rituals and being able to honour people who've died. Odysseus is often making offerings to the gods, pouring out libations, making prayers, burning sheep down to the bones as an offering to the gods. And I think there is something in that. There's a lot of resonance in some of these very old rituals. And there's a beautiful part in the poem where Odysseus goes down into the underworld to try to get some guidance from a prophet. But while he's there, he meets all his old pals from the Trojan War. And they've all got different, you know, in our language, we call it PTSD, right? So they're post-traumatic, and you would be after this horrific war. And so he meets all his old mates. And then he meets his mother. And he tries to hug her 3 times. And it's called the failed hug in a lot of translations. And I think Emily says she flew from his arms like shadows or like dreams. And that idea of a failed hug or trying to kind of reconnect with people that we've loved who have died, I think it's still really resonant today.
Well, that is a wonderful note to end this trip on. And thank you so much for taking me with you on it. If listeners want to follow along with you on your travels on the internet and buy your book, where can they find you?
So the book is called Enchanted Islands. So it's published in May. It's available for pre-order now from everywhere you buy books.
Fabulous. Okay. Next week, what it's like to cover the US election as a foreign reporter, and how eating late-night tacos in the parking lot, freezing in a flimsy tent in Tennessee, are all part of the 24-hour workday. I'm Lale Arikoglu, and you can find me on Instagram at Lale Hanna. Our engineers are Jake Loomis, Nick Pittman, and James Yost. The show's mixed by Amar Lal. Jude Kampfner from Corporation for Independent Media is our producer. Chris Bannon is Condé Nast's head of global audio.
Hi, I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor of The New Yorker and host of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast. On the podcast, I ask a great contemporary writer to select a favorite story from the magazine's almost 100-year archive to read and discuss. Together, we delve into the story, exploring its themes, its style, and what makes fiction work. You can listen to authors like Otessa Moshfegh talk about why we write.
Story, or attaching a story or creating a story, is this inclination that we all have to stop spinning.
And you can hear writers like George Saunders discuss the nature of storytelling.
On the first read, you accept these things as descriptions and they make you see the scene, but every line is a chance to inflect the reader's mind.
You'll discover new favorite authors and read old favorites in new ways. Episodes of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast are released on the first of every month. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
From PRX.